We believe that in order for repatriation to happen for the Rohingya, they need to be safe, dignified, and voluntary.
And he and others say none of that is taking place. This is Thursday, November 15th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You can be part of this program. To do that, join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the U.S. Vice President attends an Asian meeting in Singapore with much talk about China. Harsh words against Muslims from an Australian politician. We take you there. And you'll take a trip to the northernmost city in the United States. All on today's VOA Asia. We start in South Asia, where Amnesty International is calling on Myanmar and Bangladesh to end their plans to send Rohingya Muslims back to Rakhine State, where the United Nations says they're subject to extrajudicial killings and other atrocities carried out by Myanmar's military. Joining us on VOA Asia is Francisco Benscomi, the Asia-Pacific manager at Amnesty International USA. Francisco, thanks for being with us. I take it that you were one of those expressing skepticism about the repatriation. Can you explain?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on your show. We actually express harder than just skepticism. We have strong concerns with the current plans underway to repatriate the Rohingya, which according to both governments will happen tomorrow. We believe that in order for repatriation to happen for the Rohingya, they need to be safe, dignified, and voluntary. And currently the conditions on the ground do not meet any of those conditions.
Well, why is that? What are they telling you? Obviously, you have people on the ground there, as does the United Nations and many other NGOs. But nevertheless, these people are running scared. Why is that, and how are they doing that?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that Amnesty International has documented a system of apartheid within Rakhine State, where the Rohingya who currently live there and have lived there for a long time do not have access to freedom of movement, do not have access to schools, to healthcare, and none of that system of apartheid, that system of discrimination has changed. All of those conditions still very much remain currently in place. Second is that we're extremely concerned because none of the Rohingya have actually been consulted throughout this process. Many of the names that have actually appeared on the so-called list for repatriation, some of the Rohingya have actually reported that they never knew nor were they consulted about any repatriation plans. So it's clearly, there's extremely concerns with whether there's voluntary and whether both governments are complicit in a form of forced repatriation.
What is the position of both the Bangladesh and the Myanmar governments on this issue? Do they want the Rohingya to return to Myanmar?
I mean, according to public statements that we've seen, they do want them to return. And under international law, the Rohingya do have a right to voluntarily return under, you know, it's their inalienable right to do so. And they're both countries are legally bound to facilitate returns. However, we don't believe that under the current circumstances, returns can be guaranteed as safe, voluntary, and dignified under international law.
As you have probably heard, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence had a meeting with the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, in Singapore at the ASEAN meeting and said this.
This is a tragedy that has touched the hearts of millions of Americans. The violence and persecution by military and vigilantes that resulted in driving 700,000 Rohingya to Bangladesh is without excuse. The arrest and jailing of two journalists last fall was deeply troubling to millions of Americans, and I look forward to speaking with you about the premium that we place on a free and independent press.
What was your reaction to that?
First of all, I think it was a very positive sign that Vice President Pence highlighted this to Aung San Suu Kyi. He called for accountability. He brought up the concerns about repatriation deal, and he also brought up the two Reuters journalists who continue to remain in prison in Myanmar. I think it's positive that the vice president brought it up. Second, I think it was extremely concerning how Aung San Suu Kyi completely dismissed his concerns and said, you know, something to the effect of, we know our country better than you do. I think the fact that, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi hasn't met with any of the Rohingya who were affected by this, the fact that she hasn't gone to either Cox's Bazar or to Northern Rakhine State to speak to many of those communities that were affected to this, you know, shows that, you know, there's a good chance she probably doesn't know what's actually going on in her own country. And it's partly why Amnesty International earlier this week decided to withdraw our highest honor, which is the Ambassador of Conscience Award, mainly because we've seen a lack of moral and political courage by Aung San Suu Kyi to speak out on behalf of the Rohingya and to and speak out for human rights within her own country.
Francisco Benscomi of Amnesty International USA, thanks for being with us so much. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
We continue on VOA Asia. We told you that U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is the highest-ranking U.S. presence at the ASEAN summit in Singapore. Pence is touting what the Trump administration says is its commitment to keeping the Indo-Pacific region free and open. As White House correspondent Patsy Wodakuswara reports from Singapore, leaders are looking closely at what concrete offers Pence might bring to counter China's growing influence in the region.
Pence flew in from Tokyo, the first stop of his week-long tour, where he highlighted U.S. commitment to the region.
The Japan-U.S. alliance is historic. It is the cornerstone of peace and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific. And when the president directed me to represent him at the ASEAN and APEC conference, we knew that coming to Japan first was the right step.
Developing nations in Southeast Asia are hungry for infrastructure investments, and they are eager to hear what Pence will offer.
There's been the U.S.-Japan-Australia initiative on infrastructure. There's been a U.S.-Japan-India infrastructure on initiative, but not a lot of money coming into the region. What's been coming into the region has been obviously the BRI work in China.
BRI stands for Belt and Road Initiative, China's trillion-dollar investment strategy that has funded massive infrastructure projects in the region.
The One Belt, One Road initiative is a fabulous idea. I just hate the fact that China came up with it. It's a compelling vision. Ultimately, the United States is going to need to come up with its own compelling vision, its own big offer.
The big offer, which Pence is expected to highlight in Singapore, is a new $60 billion agency to facilitate private investment for projects in the developing world. The American vice president will try to convince countries in the region that this is a better alternative to BRI, which he has criticized for offering loans that can put countries deeply in debt.
China is relatively new to developmental aid, to investment infrastructure projects, and also to working with other countries. So you can see some of the growing pains.
Sri Lanka, Maldives, and Malaysia are some of the countries feeling the effects of those growing pains and rethinking their loans from China. Beijing denies accusations of debt trap diplomacy, saying its readily available loans help countries desperate for infrastructure. To succeed, the United States will have to show that its investment alternative will be ready when needed, says analysts.
Clearly, a lot of these countries want to move as quickly as possible, and it remains to be seen, to your point, how quickly the U.S. can actually stand up and operationalize some of that investment.
Countries will also be watching what Pence will be signaling on trade, including on the U.S.-Sino tariff war, another big concern for a region that wants to avoid having to choose between two giants. From Singapore, Vice President Mike Pence travels to Papua New Guinea, where he will deliver a key speech at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation CEO Summit on the details of the Trump administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Many countries in the region will be eager to hear what it's all about. Patsy Wodakuswara, VOA News in Singapore.
We are happy you are with us. Australia's first female Muslim member of parliament has criticized the prime minister for suggesting that the greatest threat to the nation's way of life is radical, violent, extremist Islam. Scott Morrison's comments came after a knife-wielding Somali-born man was shot by police after a deadly attack in Melbourne on Friday. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Labour parliamentarian Anne Ali, a former international counter-terrorism expert, says Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison's comments on extremism were divisive. Morrison detailed the threat posed by what he called the radical and dangerous ideology of extremist Islam following an attack in Melbourne. Police believe Somalian-born migrant Hassan Khalif Shire Ali, who killed one man and injured two others in a knife attack, had links to Islamic State and had been radicalized. The Prime Minister has urged Islamic communities to ensure dangerous teachings and ideologies didn't spread in Australia. An Ali was born in Egypt and moved to Australia when she was 2 years old. Elected to Parliament in 2016, she's Australia's first female Muslim parliamentarian. She believes that politicians need to focus on giving Islamic communities the expertise and confidence to defuse extremism.
We need to move beyond words of condemnation. I think we need to move beyond these calls for the Muslim community, which every law enforcement agency that I've ever spoken to recognises is a very important ally in security, and move towards an effective prevention and intervention, early intervention mechanism.
Other Islamic leaders believe Friday's deadly attack in Melbourne was a result of failures by Australia's security agencies. The attacker, Shire Ali, previously had his Australian passport cancelled due to concerns he planned to travel to Syria in 2015. Despite being known to hold radical views, he wasn't actively monitored by intelligence agencies and wasn't deemed a threat. He was shot by the police during the attack and died later in the hospital. Meanwhile, a funding campaign has raised almost $85,000 to help a homeless man who tried to stop the attack by ramming him with a shopping trolley. Michael Rogers was filmed trying to stop Shire Ali from stabbing two police officers. The terrorism suspect had already killed a cafe owner and injured two other people. Australia's terror threat level remains at probable. There are 600,000 Muslims in Australia. Islam is the most prominent non-Christian religion in the country. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Now on VOA Asia, everything about the city of Barrow, Alaska is special. The northernmost city in the U.S., it is home to indigenous carvers, fishermen, researchers, and teachers doing their best to preserve the native Inupiaq language. But at the center of the culture is a whale. It is its food, its symbol, and its soul. Natasha Muscovaya set off to Alaska to see what life is like in this frozen place. Anna Rice narrates her story.
The native Alaskan Inupiaq people who settled here thousands of years ago hunted the bowhead whales in the Arctic waters, and the harvest was shared with the entire community. Now, just like then, the whale is at the center of life and culture. The city's seal of Barrow, now known as Utqiagvik, proudly sports the magnificent animal. Its landscape includes palm trees made of baleen. One of the first things the children learn is how to help with whaling.
So that's why we take our kids out at a young age, you know. It's something you don't learn overnight. You just learn over the years. So, you know, I feel very confident that, you know, Lord willing, you know, we'll go on for another 1,000 years.
In Barrow, whales mean not just food. In a town with few attractions, they are at the center of the Nalukatak Festival, celebrating a successful whaling season. It begins with a solemn prayer. Then people enjoy traditional treats, from geese soup to whale meat and fat.
Getting our Eskimo food that we survive on, and hot soup on a cold day.
Captains eventually join in under the midnight sun on this polar day. With all the fun, however, it's easy to forget how much hard work goes into preparing for the whaling season.
All year round, we're preparing for the whale hunt, and it's about feeding people, about feeding the community and making sure nobody goes hungry, and encouraging every able-bodied person to participate in the hunt, to keep your culture alive, keep your traditions alive.
That tradition is grueling and risky.
It's really dangerous. I mean, you're in a 20-foot boat, paddling up to a whale that's, you know, 30 to 60 feet big. So, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, little things that could go wrong. And it's just dangerous all the way around.
For Natasha Muscovaya in Barrow, Alaska, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Have a wonderful day. We'll be right back.